Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 4th, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings. I think it's 2017, but I could be wrong.
Did I say the wrong year?
You said 16.
Oh. I was only hoping we had a chance, but I guess not. 2017, good catch. Tim?
Good evening, sir.
Welcome, Tim. I'm all discombobulated. That's what happens when you take a week off. For those of you that missed us last week, Catherine had a huge birthday event. Happy belated birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
And Tim had a friend coming to sing the Lord's music just north of his house. So he went to see him, and I just got lazy and took the week off since everybody else was. So, but we're back with you this week. And also this week, we got a guest coming up in about 20 minutes, Lachlan McIntosh of South Carolina. He's going to talk all things about the Palmetto State, and we might ask him about something else. Who knows? But until then, we got a lot to catch up on. First thing first. Yeah, I've said this for a while. Of all the things that Donald Trump and the Republicans could tear up, can fix most of them. People may suffer in the interim. You know, how big an issue it is, healthcare, education, the economy, those can be repaired. But our earth, if we get it completely out of balance, it may not be fixable. Just don't know. And so that's why it's such a risky proposition to take chances. We're the only planet that we know that's habitable. Every nation on the face of the earth has a climate accord, except for Syria, who was embroiled in a civil war, and Nicaragua, who many leaders thought that the Paris Agreement did not go far enough. He, of course, signed this under President Obama, but Donald Trump, I guess, had an eraser. I guess he assumed President Obama was using one of those Papermate pens, and he's erased it off, and we've pulled out, so we're now one of three nations. And I've even heard that Nicaragua may decide to now sign it because they don't want to be involved in any group that Donald Trump's a part of. Tim, how shocking of a move was this?
Well, I wasn't particularly shocked, although I was hoping that he would forget that he said during the campaign that he was going to do this, and that he said a couple of years ago that, climate change, global warming is a hoax. I think it'll wind up, of course, hurting us as a country more than it hurts everyone else who stays in it. I mean, listen to this. Even the coal companies wanted us to stay in it. Now think about that for a second, because they wanted a seat at the table to present their case. Well, the coal industry that he loves so much, he just knifed them too. The climate, of course, will suffer. Our goal was to reduce the rise of global temperatures to less than 3.6 degrees, because anything above that, and we're talking about irreversible damage to the environment. And another bad thing is we've surrendered more leadership. This America First stuff is actually sounding more like America Last. Guys on Secretary of State opposed this move. Back in January, something like 31% supported Trump's decision to get out of this, and 56% opposed it. Well, now 70% oppose his move. He did this, I guess, to appease his base and no one else, because he didn't make anybody else happy. his economic arguments on it, of course, if anybody had the stomach to watch his little talk the other day, they're just a pack of lies. And in my opinion, and he's made some whoppers, this is the worst decision he's made as president. Wouldn't you agree with that, Catherine?
Yeah, well, there's a lot that I disagree with the decisions that he's made, but as a sweeping sort of declaration of lies and disbelief in science and facts and stepping away from international leadership, it's a horrible, horrible decision. And the thing that I keep coming back to is, okay, so so if you want to believe that man doesn't have as much of a hand in global warming and climate change as science says, we still see the results of, we see the damage that is being done. So whatever the reason for it, it should be addressed. It should be where we can make changes that will make it better, we should do it. Whatever the reason for why it's happening. I mean, I know, I believe that what the scientists tell me, but even if you don't believe that, we still have a obligation to leave our children, grandchildren, and future generations with a planet on which they can live. And that's the thing that bugs me, is like, okay, so you don't believe in what the scientists say, but we still have a problem. Whether you believe, whatever the source is, we still have a problem, and we still need to, where we can, we should address it.
Yes. And I'm the speech you talked about, Donald Trump had a famous line in it: I got elected by the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris. Now, some very ironic things about that. One, if you look at the results in the city of Pittsburgh, Donald Trump really didn't win them, so he didn't get elected by the people of Pittsburgh. And secondly, Mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto, and I may be saying his name wrong, he actually came out with a statement that said that he would have stayed in the Paris Treaty, and he believes the people of Pittsburgh would not support a move like this. And what's so funny is I've heard that for many years now, the city of Pittsburgh hadn't had a functioning steel mill, which I'm sure is what he was thinking about, not necessarily the art of Andy Warhol that Pittsburgh also is famous for. How tone-deaf does he get at times, Tim, when he makes statements like this? Wouldn't it have been a little more appropriate to say, hey, I got elected by the people of Podunk instead of Paris if he wanted to have alliteration?
No, he's always just thrown stuff out there, whatever flew into that empty head of his. He's done that on the internet. He's done that when he's talking. But still, he was talking to one group and one group only, and he keeps talking to just that one group, his base. He don't try to expand anything. He just keeps talking to his base of support, and that is all, as if it will be enough to sustain him. That's a calculated gamble that I don't know if that's so well for him or not, but what do I know, being he's not lost anything yet. But David, Catherine and I'm not going to give our ages exactly, but let's just say we're old enough to remember the times before the Clean Air and Water Act, before the EPA and all that. I remember that silt from those plants that were using coal getting into the Cuyahoga River and actually catching the river on fire. I believe it was June 22nd of 1969, if I'm not mistaken. I remember things like that happen. I remember acid rain. I remember seeing film footage of Los Angeles when you couldn't see 50 feet in front of you on a sunny day. I remember the wet redwood forest being endangered. I remember, and Catherine will certainly remember this because of the part of the country she's from, I remember Lake Erie being declared dead. The whole Great Lake dead. Do we want to go back to stuff like that? We don't go backwards in this country. Everything about this is wrong. Everything. He's talking about coal. We're not going to go backwards to coal. That's not going to happen. Natural gas is cheaper. Everybody's going to that. Solar, everybody's going to that. Wind power, everybody's going to that. We don't go backwards. It's not going to happen. I just, I don't
well,
know.
It's, well, I think you're right. We're not going to go ahead.
Well, no, we're just all wanting to make such good points because there's so much here. But, you know, Tim, you mentioned coal and the coal industry. I think the Washington Post, they did an analysis of jobs. About 85,000 people are employed in America by the coal industry. 86,000 people in America are employed by Arby's. And while Arby's is the king of roast beef sandwiches and they have the good dollar check, they're not by any means the largest franchise in our country. And so to think about, if somebody says, we have to do all these things to save Arby's, people go, well, you know, so it's just so crazy that that people put it that way. Also, you look at the fact that so many more jobs can be created through green energy. I don't know all the specifics, but I would like to learn, is there a way that you can put more of these jobs in the disaffected areas? Can you do these green jobs more, or these plants more in, not plants, but, you know, wind farms, solar farms, whatever they may be, in places like West Virginia and Kentucky? Or is there not enough sunlight? Do they have to be Sunbelt jobs? And if they have to be, they just have to be. But to me, that might be a way to kind of get more of those folks on board. Hey, we may lose 10,000 coal jobs, but we're going to make 15,000 clean energy jobs in Appalachia. And so, therefore, you have a net increase of 5,000 jobs, if you know, over the next, say, 5 years. Catherine?
Well, the other thing about this is that, you know, they talk about how these, you know, climate change regulations are costing us jobs. That's not what's costing us jobs. It's automation. It's mechanization. It's not – we've been losing coal jobs for decades because of automation. We need to address automation in employment as much as we need to address whatever these, you know, whatever regulations they always talk about, not just in climate change, but they're always talking about regulations, losing us jobs. That's not what's losing jobs. It's automation. It's computers. It's technology. And that's good, right? Because it's not good for the workers, but it's good for productivity, if we look at productivity in a much larger scale than just individuals. But we need to address how we handle losing jobs to automation, because it's not going to stop. Companies are not going to stop advancing their technological abilities just because they're losing jobs. So we need to address this. We need to address this head on. What is the solution to employment when we start really, and then we look at the retail industry, which we've talked about before, which we're going to lose a whole bunch of jobs there too. So we need to talk about what we do when we don't have jobs for all the people in this country, full-time, benefits included jobs. We need to talk about it, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, there's two things there. One, when I was working, when I was going through my graduate program for education, we talked a lot about teaching students to become knowledge workers. And if you teach people to be the ones that repair and code the robots and things like that, they're going to make more. They're probably going to be happier. There may be less health risk. Talked about this before. It seems like there's just this base of people, and it's a very small group, but it's a very hardcore group that just wants to eschew education. It's like, we don't want to learn and get skills. We want to, you know, move widget from point A to point B and do what a robot can do, and those people are just going to have to, you know, move on from that base of thought. That, to me, that's one of the big things in all of this, is figuring that out. Tim, what were you going to say?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking of something. We were talking about renewable energy a minute ago and those jobs and where they might could be moved. I heard John Kerry talking on television this weekend about some of the absurd things that Donald Trump came up with during all of this. And he mentioned that fully one half of all the renewable energy jobs in this country, which, by the way, dwarf the number of coal jobs in this country by a factor of like eight times over, one half of them in this country are located in states that Donald Trump won. So what is he thinking here when he's hurting, trying to hurt an industry that is employing eight times the number of people that coal is employing, not to mention half of those jobs are in states that he won? What does he think? There's a good question to consider. Does he even think? Good grief.
I think we need to look at. Go ahead.
I think a really important thing to remember is that our electric companies, you know, like Southern Company and whatever the northern state, the northern country, the northern electric companies are, they make money because they provide electricity and they run large plants, and their bottom line is dependent on none of us like going off the grid or taking advantage of lower cost power. So, and I mean, I'm not accusing Southern Company of anything, but I mean, I think that they have to think about their bottom line too, and how they can continue to thrive and serve their shareholders and serve their employees in a new energy environment. And I'm not sure they've accomplished that yet. And I imagine they have a closer ear, that they have a closer ear to the president than I do.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's more than just coal involved, and there's just
right.
The way that things work. But then, you know, we mentioned Rex Tillerson was for this. He was an ExxonMobil executive. The oil industry would not be the most pro-environment group. I'm not going to say they're 2365 anti-environment, but they're not the most pro-environment. And yet he wanted to stay in. Speaking of like where the power bases in this thing, from everything we've been told, Ivanka Trump was for staying in this, and she didn't get her way. What does that say about her power, Tim?
Well, it says that Steve Bannon still has a little bit more to say than we thought, because he was all for what Donald Trump did. We just got to say he got his way, and she did not, right?
Yeah, I think Jared Kushner was on the same page.
Do we really know that about them, though? That's what we keep hearing.
Here's what's the context of that. Say that when Al Gore went to meet with Donald Trump during the transition, that Ivanka Trump helped set that up, that she was a big proponent. So either one of two things happened. Either she, you know, wanted to move somewhat to the middle or closer to the middle on environmental issues, or she wanted the appearance of her being pro-environment. Either way, she lost out in that she is more pro-environment, or she's more pro-appearance of pro-environment. Because the meeting with Al Gore went on CNN this morning and, you know, talked about what a disastrous decision this is. Tim?
Well, it is people like Bannon who, in a general sense, have influenced Trump heavily with this America First idea. And this is part of the thing to withdraw from things like this, to It's almost like they're willing to surrender leadership by claiming they're showing leadership by surrendering leadership. I'm not even sure I followed what I just said. But
no,
but
I think you're right.
It's maddening. It's maddening. You know, the Chinese now are going to take the initiative and the lead on this thing. The Chinese. Goodness.
Yeah, I saw that, and obviously, as far as from a leadership position, that is very sad since America's been a world leader, the world leader, for at least 75 years straight now. But then if you look at it as a population issue is a big component of this, China and India, if they don't change their ways,
David,
we're in trouble.
David, we're the,
they have
we're
so many billions of people.
David, we're still the number two polluter in the world. We should get out on front. Out front
we
on
should.
This and show some leadership.
Well,
I'm just saying China has so many people. It's Catherine?
Well, I mean, we're the number one polluter, but if we did it per capita, we'd be way number one.
Actually, in aggregate pollution, we're number two in the world.
Oh, really?
In total pollution, yes, ma'am, we are. Because of our industrialization, of course.
Yeah.
We are the number two polluter
on the
planet.
And either way, that's not a silver medal you can be proud of, no matter how you can cut it.
No.
Well, let's look at another angle. And this is the article I sent y'all to kind of get into this whole thing. And that was that the governors of, and tell me if I've got the wrong states, California, Washington, and New York. I may be wrong on the New York, but I know Jerry Brown was looking at this a long time ago in Washington as well. They have said they want to make a coalition of governors of states that want to sign the Paris Agreement, and they want to take the leadership. Where will this go, and will this cause that California-America federal government rift to accelerate? I mean, what do you see the outcome of that being, Catherine?
I have to applaud their leadership. I just wonder about, like, logistics of things like that. Like, how does it work? Can they really sign something as an independent state? Like, I don't know how it works. But bravo to them for trying to figure it out. You know, they're gonna try to make a negotiation. I think that's great. Maybe it will put pressure on other governors, including Republican governors. Maybe it will put pressure on Congress and the Senate to take some action. Or maybe it'll just, you know, give us a better vision for the future. And that's certainly important. And then Bloomberg stepped up and said he was going to give, you know, whatever, how many ever billions of dollars to shore things up with the UN, so in terms of climate change.
Well, before we get Tim's thoughts, let's go ahead and welcome our guest onto the program. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine for the multiple times, I'm not sure how many, Mr. Lachlan McIntosh. Welcome, Lachlan.
Thank you. Good to be back. Always good to be on the show.
Yes. Well, the Palmetto state politics is always fascinating, but it's taken on a little more fascination in that one of the remaining three, because I'm counting the Alabama U.S. Senate races, one of the three federal special elections is in your state. Archie Parnell is the Democrat. The Republican that won slips my mind. I'm not sitting right in front of my computer. But they
Norman.
Do a primary process. Where you get down to a Democrat and Republican. It's not an open primary. But we went through that process. Tell us kind of where we stand after the primaries, and now we're on the head-to-head in that race.
Right. Well, you know, obviously it's very different than the Atlanta area race in the sense it's not getting the national attention. And for several reasons. One is it's a much more Republican district. I think that Trump carried the district by around 20 percentage points, whereas I think that Trump carried the Atlanta district by a couple of points. So that's a big difference. There was, much like the Atlanta race, there was a huge Republican primary. A guy named Ralph Norman, who's independently wealthy, won in the runoff. You know, Parnell is a guy who actually worked for Goldman Sachs, was one of their lawyers for years and years and years, lived in overseas in Asia for decades, is originally from the district and has moved back in recent years. It's not getting the money that you're seeing in the Atlanta district, not even close. But, you know, some interesting things are happening in the sense that just like other places around the country, you have a very, very excited Democratic base. And it is big. There are enough Democrats in that district to win. This is the old John Spratt district, and it hasn't changed significantly over redistricting. There are enough Democrats to win in the district. I think that everything would have to go right. It could actually be that the fact is that the race is not getting all the national attention may in some way work out in Parnell's favor, because obviously special elections are always about motivation and they're always about turnout. And there is no question that Democrats are more motivated than Republicans. The problem in this district is that there are just so many more Republicans. And they're not the kind of Republicans that you see in the Georgia race. These are more rural, less educated types. You do have a little bit of the suburban area around Charlotte, but I think that it's not one to completely give up on. I really don't. I think that every day that this president says things, does things, it's just going to have an effect on all these kind of races, I think.
Yes, you mentioned the name that it was going to be the basis of my next question. You know, looking at Georgia 6, now it has changed, but it hadn't had a Democrat in a long, long time. You know, you're going back probably to when Carter and Talmadge were in charge of the state of Georgia, since you could find a Democrat that won in that congressional district. But in the one that we're talking about in South Carolina, John Spratt, less than 10 years ago, served, and you're saying the district hadn't changed the lines much. What's changed about the people or the voting patterns that they can't just want to find their next John Spratt, particularly in this
right.
anti-Trump environment?
Well, I think it's the type of voter here, the type of Republican. You know, it's the rural, less educated type of a white voter who yes, were Democrats 20, 30 years ago, you know, have been moving a long time to the Republican Party. You know, they kind of would vote for folks like a Fritz Hollings or a John Spratt. But, you know, we saw those people completely leave the Democratic Party during the Obama years, all over the South, all over the country. We continue to see that, obviously, in other parts of the country, Michigan, Wisconsin. And these are folks who are very attracted, for whatever reason, to Trump's message. You know, the difference what you have in Georgia is a more educated, suburban, wealthy, or at least upper middle class type of voter who went to college, you know, who has a better sense of what's going on in the world right now and how bad Trump is. You know, the Georgia district was one of the few districts that Hillary Clinton did better than Barack Obama. You know, this is not one of those kind of districts. This district reflects the continued trending away from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party by rural white, non-college educated type voters.
Yeah, so I'm going to pass it on to Tim and Catherine before I take up all the material here.
Let me say this about the district, though, that it does have a very, very large Democratic base. It's almost 30% African-American. It does have, you know, like I said, it does have the Charlotte suburb, so you do have a touch of your more college-educated, oriented voters who are not Trump fans. It is one because of those two things to keep an eye out on. If the Republican turnout is very, very low, and what I said earlier, this fact that nobody thinks this is a race that's not getting the national attention, that's not on the radar screen, could have a positive effect.
Yes. Tim?
Yes, sir. Good evening, Mr. McIntosh. Thank you
good
for
evening.
Being with us again.
My pleasure.
You just mentioned something I was just about to ask you. 28% of the voters in that district are black. The question is, and has been historically, how do you rev them up and get them to the polls, especially in an election like this, a special election that's not a general election? So if the average black voter said to you, why should I vote in this race, what would you say to them?
Well, you know, I don't think, honestly, I think you're going to see a good Democratic turnout. I definitely think there's going to be a disproportionately larger Democratic turnout than Republican turnout. I believe that you're seeing Democrats of all races and sizes and shapes and their religions that are very fired up, and for good reason, obviously, what's going on in this country. You know, I think that I think that obviously Trump is the issue here. Trump and the Republican Congress is absolutely the issue here. I think people, Democrats, are tuned into this. You know, I think that the problem with, you know, I mentioned earlier that the fact that the race is not getting a lot of national attention, not getting the money, could be a good thing. It could put Republicans to sleep. The flip side of that is, you know, we don't have the money. We're not seeing the money to go into the ground campaign and the intense door-to-door field operations. There's some of that going on, don't get me wrong. More than usual. I mean, more than there would be in other circumstances in a race like that. It's not like Parnell has no money. He does. He'll be on TV. He does have a field organization. So, but I don't think there's much doubt of what the message is. And the message is that we've got to fight Trump and defeat Trump in every possible chance that we have. If we want this country to look, be the same country that it's always been. And I definitely think you're going to see a disproportionately larger Democratic turnout than Republican. The problem is, it's just the gap between Democrats and Republicans in this particular district.
Now, in the Georgia 6, and Catherine and David might correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they've got four debates scheduled. They've already had one. They're having one tonight, and I believe they have two more coming up. And there's talk in that race in South Carolina that they're having trouble getting together on whether there will even be a debate at all.
Have you heard anything
about why there's a problem there?
I have not heard any talk of a public debate here. I think it just goes to the lack of attention that the race is getting nationally, and I think that spills down to the local media. I think a lot of folks believe that since the Republican primary has been decided, that the race is over. And look, normally that would probably be the case. I just don't think that's necessarily the case this particular year. I did notice today on social media that Norman, the Republican, did attack the Democrat that he called the tax collector, some nonsense. But that was interesting that he felt like he needed to even address Archie, which I think is probably an interesting sign. Now, John Anzalone is a well-known pollster. I'm sure a lot of you guys know him or worked with him. And he is Parnell's pollster. And he released a poll, I think, late last week, or early last week, actually, that had the race within 10 points, that had the Republican up by 10 points. Now, usually you'd say, well, 10 points, that's not close. And it may not be, but 10 points in a special election that's all motivated by turnout is a different ballgame. To me, 10 points means if you can flip the script on turnout a little bit, you can make that race a lot closer.
Wow. And with that, I'll swing it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, Lachlan. Thanks for being on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Catherine.
So is Norman identifying himself as a Trump guy? Is he, you know, outwardly, you know, supporting like the climate change and all this stuff? And so he's on board with the Trump.
He's not feeling, and of course either did Mulvaney, obviously, in the last election, feel when he ran for re-election last year and had actually a well-financed opponent and still won by 20. A lot of us were surprised at how much Mulvaney embraced Trump during the campaign, but it turned out it was the right decision. This is a Trump district. Make no mistake about it. It is a lot of working class, rural, non-college educated white voters who like Trump. So he is not backing down from that. I heard rumor that there was some polling a few months ago that still had Trump's numbers positive in this district. Again, a lot's happened since that poll, which with the president, every day or every other day, the kind of craziness we're hearing and seeing. I think that obviously not in the next 2 weeks or probably the next 2 years. I don't think you're going to see Trump supporters in a district like this turn their backs on him yet, and for some time. But I think that what you could see is them not being excited anymore, or them just
right.
not
and
being
I
motivated.
Think that's what, I think that's what we're all counting on in the sixth district and hopefully maybe in Alabama and maybe in this district, is that they might not come out and vote for the Democrat, but they might just stay home and, you know, go to the beach or not vote before they go on vacation or whatever, you know, whatever the
worry about other things in their lives. They're not going to
exactly.
admit to us they're disappointed in Trump for a long time. Yeah. They're not going
right.
to admit to their liberal friend, their one liberal friend, that they were right. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
And when is the election?
The election is the same day as Georgia 6th.
Oh, so it's the 20th. And do you have early voting in South Carolina?
We don't have early voting. We have a very liberal absentee voting policy, which has already started. And you know, I do not have numbers, but it is. I'm not actually involved in the race. But essentially 30 days before the election, you can go in and vote absentee as long as you have a reason. I'm going to be out of town, or you know, I've got to work, or whatever. And if you're 65 or over, that's your reason. So it's not early voting, but it acts a lot like early voting. You can do it in person or by mail.
Okay. Well, so, that's very similar. The only, here, so you have to just go to your county office. Here we just have locations where you can early vote. So it's
right.
not that much different, really.
It's not. And it's something that Democrats outperform Republicans on all over the state.
Yeah, see, in Georgia, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but it used to be that absentee voting, Republicans were dominant, but the early voting, Democrats were. So.
Yeah, interesting. In South Carolina, it's absentee voting by mail, Republicans are dominant in, but people that just show up at their county offices, that's usually dominated by Democrats. So.
Which is pretty much the same as what I'm
right.
I think what I'm saying.
Right.
And so you said there is some activity on the ground. Is that by the party, or are there like independent investments going on in from, you know, like whatever the Sierra Club, Planned Parenthood, you know, whatever?
They really aren't. It's really the campaign oriented. I mean, obviously the state party, which didn't have any money, is trying their best, and they're organizing phone banks, you know, through other parts of the state where folks, you know, Democratic activists can call from Charleston, of course, which is not in the district, or Greenville or Myrtle Beach or wherever, and that's happening. And of course, it's more than normal. But no, you know, the DCCC nor the NRCC are playing in this race right now. It's much quieter. We don't see the kind of independent investment.
Well, you know, like you said, that might be. I mean,
it's
good that you don't have all the Koch brothers money, because that's what's happening here. You know, there's like the Heritage Foundation, Koch, all these guys are. You know, we hear a lot about how the Ossoff campaign got a lot of money from outside sources, but really the most outside money is coming on the Republican side for Karen Handel. So
sure.
That's one of those. Fake news stories that we keep hearing, that, you know, Ossoff is a Pelosi liberal, but really Karen Handel is a Trump conservative.
Right. Well, that's their favorite thing to do, is to accuse us exactly what they do. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's so true. Ever since I think that became really prominent during the Bush years.
That was Karl Rove's Bible. Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's right. Well, thanks so much. I'm going to pass it back to David. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you.
Yes. Well, you mentioned Mick Mulvaney, who vacated the seat. Now, he's kind of known, rightly or wrongly, as the father of the latest health care agreement, because it's so budget intensive. It's really more about budgets and tax cuts than it is about health care. And that's the most unpopular issue. I mean, if you believe in polling, we're seeing – you know, that hurts Donald Trump a lot more than even the Russia thing does with a lot of voters. Is there any kind of negative blowback on Mick Mulvaney, given that he's seen as the architect of the latest health care agreement, which just didn't seem to be that popular in any quarters?
You know, of course there is among, you know, people that are informed. But, you know, obviously the problem we have are Republican voters, Trump voters more specifically, which dominate like the 5th District, is that they don't know. They're not getting any news. They're getting their news from Fox or, you know, fake news, if you will, and they're just not aware. I mean, the majority of Republicans, a huge majority of Republicans, support this health care bill, even though it probably hurt them the most. So it's obviously the frustrating times that we live in. You know, again, in a district like Atlanta 6, you're just going to have a more educated electorate, even on the Republican side, that can see this kind of stuff. And South Carolina 5 is just very different there. If it's not on the Fox News, they don't know what's happening.
Yes. Well, let me kind of change gears. Somebody a few years ago that was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, the conservative movement, was Jim DeMint. I mean, I had heard him touted as a Republican presidential nominee, and therefore the Republicans would have said he was a good chance to be in president. But he left to become the head of a conservative PAC. And then lately he's resigned that position, and it seems like his star has just, you know, much more than faded, just crashed. What's kind of the in-state take on the rise and fall of Jim DeMint?
You know, it's interesting. It certainly got some attention here, but he's there hasn't been the kind of buzz you would think that there'd be about it. He certainly got his supporters, but, you know, I mean, he failed so spectacular at the Heritage Heritage Council that it's just kind of a stunning. I guess the buzz is what a stunning fall. It was bizarre that he would leave the Senate in the first place. He left the Senate probably because he wasn't very good at being a senator. He wasn't very respected by his colleagues. Probably, honestly, just not bright enough to really make a difference. He had all these really strong ideas that he had that weren't based on fact or reality. more of the strange, very strange world that he lived in. And, you know, he thought Heritage would be his home, but the truth is he's too strange and bizarre and lacks basic, we'll say, curiosity that he couldn't even fit in there. So, I don't know what his future would hold. Maybe I'll see him one day at the gas station and he can fill up my tank. I think that'd be an appropriate place for him. But it's a good sign. I mean, I guess if you're too dumb for the Heritage Foundation, you're pretty dumb.
Yeah, y'all laugh, but I've met Tom Price one time. It was at a QT and a dare. So stranger things happen than running into Republican politicians at gas stations. Well, let me ask you about one more thing. Talking about somebody that you think would have crashed in South Carolina politics but kind of rose from the ashes is Mark Sanford. Now, we know many years ago he had his Appalachian hiking trail that somehow took a detour in Argentina, and he was disgraced, and it seemed like he was just going to fade away, but he came back. But then I have a larger question. That seemed to be the first person in a string of Republican politicians that seemingly came back from things you just don't think they could. David Bitter won re-election in Louisiana after all kind of sordid stories came out about him. I don't have enough time to go. You have Congressman-elect Greg, and I'm going to say the name wrong, but from Montana, who slapped around a reporter, won office the next day. Now, of course, he could have won by the mail-in votes, but I have a funny feeling he would have won either way. And then third, you have the big guy, Donald Trump, who everything came out on, and he still won the presidency. Was Mark Sanford kind of a lowering of the bar for the Republicans? Was he kind of the trendsetter, if you will?
You know, that's a good point. It's an interesting topic. I'm definitely a fan of Mark Sanford. The guy is, you know, narcissistic and bizarre and has a very strange view on the world and on politics in general and what his role is. But I kind of, in this way, it's similar. He was disgraced. His numbers were very bad. I don't think he could have ever been reelected governor. Could he run again when this happened? limped through the Republican primary when he ran for Congress in a very weak field. He beat, you know, he's the Charleston Lowcountry district. He got in a runoff with kind of a fundamentalist type social conservative, which in the Charleston area, if you know South Carolina, it may be Republican, less so Republican actually, but it's not a social kind of Republican. It's very different. He had a runoff against that guy and won, and then really just nationalized his initial election against Stephen Colbert's sister, and it's, you know, Democrat versus Republican, it's Nancy Pelosi versus me. You know, and that is similar because obviously Republicans are going to, like in Montana, they're at the point in their existence where they're going to vote for anybody against a Democrat because of the indoctrination they've been under in the right-wing media. But I don't think that it's the first time. I mean, I think if you go back in history, I mean, I looked at Reagan. Republicans didn't abandon Reagan when he sold arms to the Ayatollah, the same weapons that were used to later kill Americans. You know, imagine had Obama done that. Imagine had Clinton done that. I mean, there'd be a civil war in the streets. Republic, you know, Republicans, you know, their corruption and scandal are bipartisan, right? Both parties. But I do think there are big differences in how Republican voters and Democratic voters have, for a long time now, reacted to this. I mean, could you imagine Democrat, Newt Gingrich, you know, never went away. He is still a major leader in the Republican Party. And he left in absolute distress. That would be like us having John Edwards still around. You know, I mean, or Anthony Weiner. And it would just never happen on our side. But I don't think there's any question that maybe what started with Nixon even and Reagan, Sanford was an example. I think that has just blown up into something that's very scary and out of control, whereas Republican voters just absolutely don't care at all what their people do as long as they have that R by their name, as long as they're fighting the evil Democrats. And I don't think there's any question that that's, you know, gotten worse and worse and worse. I don't think it started with Sanford. I think there were some similarities in that. But, you know, Mark Sanford, of course, has been one of the few elected Republicans who's been very critical of Donald Trump in a lot of his statements and policies. It's hard to believe that, you know, Mark Sanford's one of the rational ones, but that's kind of the way it's been here in the last few months.
Yes, I mean, it is ironic, but he was kind of the start of something in many ways. Well, let me ask Tim and Catherine if they got anything else on South Carolina before I let you go. Tim?
Yes, sir. I do have a question or two, as a matter of fact. Another thing we were talking about before you came on with us was about the president withdrawing from the Paris Accords and the fact that several state governors had said essentially they were going to make separate deals. Now, there's 85 mayors in this country who have also stated that they would uphold the standards of the Paris Accords and oppose Donald Trump, and one of them is the mayor of your capital city, Steve Benjamin.
Correct.
Will that be viewed as a popular move with the average voter and the business community up in Columbia?
With the average, yeah, and yet another mayor, I think they've released a new list, actually. I think it's a lot larger than that now. John Tecklenburg, the mayor of Charleston, is mm-hmm. on the list. I believe a mayor of Anderson, which is a city in the upstate, is on the list. I think for voters in the city and in the business community, yeah, absolutely, it will be a popular thing for their in particular constituents. You know, I think what we see in South Carolina and so many other places in these towns and cities that have some kind of a population, they're much, you know, much more progressive on issues like this. It's the rural areas, you know, that are so far the other way. But yeah, I think it's a good political move for Mayor Benjamin Tecklenburg and the mayor of Anderson too in their city. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see more, honestly, in particular on the coast, because the South Carolina coast will be one of the first areas, you know, majorly affected
yeah.
by what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you
know? It would be like bye-bye Frith Island or something, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And you know, I don't think there's any, you know, if you watch that Gallup poll, and obviously it does swing a little bit here in the margins, but since Trump has announced his decision to pull out of of the Paris Agreement, is, I think his popularity went from 2 to 36. I do think this issue is bigger than a lot of people realize. I think that there's a lot of, you know, I do think there's still a group of Trump supporters who are hanging on to him, who aren't crazy, who aren't, you know, terrible people. And I actually think this is going to be one of those issues that's going to have a bigger effect on than people think, that the pundits think. I think this is going to be one of those things where a lot of his voters that are educated, that are worldly, are going to say, hey, this is a step too far. Why would the United States be one of three countries in the world to oppose this agreement? That, you know, that's strong.
Yeah, would you agree with something I said earlier then, Lackland, that this is probably the very worst thing to date that Donald Trump has done as president?
That's a heck of a statement. That's hard to say because there's so much. But historically, it really could be. You know, I mean, I just can't believe what he said today about the mayor of London. I still, for some reason, am shocked when I wake up in the morning and read his tweets. But I do. I think historically, it's certainly one of the most embarrassing things I think that he's done for our country. It's not him making a snide comment or shoving another NATO leader or. I mean, it's the real deal, and you know, U.S. presidents can't do a whole lot of things this big because of the way the structure is set up. But he did this, and very embarrassing, very sad.
Obviously,
I think it's a political mistake whether he believes in it or not, though, and I think we're starting to see that from the Gallup polling and the fact that it doesn't happen for 4 years. I think gives all of us, Democrats and principal Republicans, a battle cry here in these next elections. In particular, coastal areas, whatnot.
Yeah, and with that, I'll swing it back over to Catherine. Catherine?
I'm all done. I don't have any other. I think we've had a really comprehensive conversation here.
I think so, too.
I wanted to put something on your radar
screen.
Go ahead.
Do you have a few minutes? Do you have a few minutes?
Sure,
or are we out of time?
Ahead.
Oh, no.
I wanted to put.
No, we can make time for you.
Well, thank you. I wanted to put something on your radar screen. It's an election that I'm working on in the South, and we're always looking for opportunities to win in the South. And Tuesday will be a city council and mayor's elections in Meridian, Mississippi. And the mayor of Meridian is a Democrat. His name is Percy Bland. He was elected 4 years ago. He was the first African-American ever elected to as mayor of Meridian. And, of course, Meridian is a city with a very, very sad and terrible history during the Civil Rights Movement, the Freedom Summer. Cheney, Goodman, Schwerner were based out of Meridian. And he won 4 years ago, like I said, in a relatively close election. Not only was the first African-American mayor elected ever, he was the first Democratic mayor elected in 20 years or more. And, of course, back those Democrats were a little different back in those days. You know, he is going to win. He's going to get reelected. To show you how fast times have changed, there's an independent candidate in that race, and I think the Republican may come in third. And there is also right now the Republicans control Meridian City Council 3-2, and I think it's almost a guarantee that Democrats are going to flip that 3-2, and it may be 4-1. And so some exciting things to watch Tuesday out of Meridian. And look, some of it has to do with the individual politics of Meridian and what's going on there on a local level, but everything that's going on national cannot be discounted by kind of turnout I think you're going to see, but kind of a higher, much higher Democratic turnout than you see in Republican turnout. And I hope if it happens the way I kind of see it happening, it'll get a little attention.
And I hope
if it
comes to pass, I hope it's a precursor of things to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, really.
If it can happen in Meridian, Mississippi, it can happen anywhere.
Yes. Well, Lachlan, we thank you for being on the show. And on Wednesday, I'm heading to Hilton Head, South Carolina, for my short summer vacation this year.
Well,
I'll
enjoy it.
State.
Have fun. Hope the weather will be good.
Yes. Well, that was thanks again, Lachlan.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was Lachlan McIntosh, our expert in South Carolina politics. And really now sounds like somebody we could call on for Mississippi politics, working in Mississippi. Well, we got about five more minutes, and there's so many things that we need to cover. We're not going to get them all. But the first overseas state trip of the Trump administration seems like one we need to give a little time to. And to me, the seminal moment, because I think it had started the last time we were on the air with the Middle Eastern leg, but the European leg is when he really hit his stride. There was apparently a photo op with the leaders, and he pulls back out of the way the Prime Minister of Montenegro. I just don't know who does that. What, you know, level-headed adult does that to another adult in just a regular situation? I mean, I don't think the Prime Minister of Montenegro had confronted or affronted or offended Donald Trump in any way that I've heard reported. He just happened to be standing closer to the camera. Catherine, I'm sure you've seen this visual more than once. What did you make of it?
It reminded me of I don't know. I'm not good about childhood development, but about a 4-year-old trying to get in center of attention so he got the first piece of cake or the first, you know, cheeseburger or hot dog or whatever. Like, he just wanted to be in the front. But, you know, I have to tell you, that was really horrifying. But I think the thing that bothered me the most was when they were doing their tour, when all the world leaders were walking the streets of that Sicilian town, and Donald Trump was behind them in a golf cart. All the leaders are walking, rolling through the town, but no, our president is in a golf cart, like, you know, a few feet behind them. He can't join the group because he was so exhausted.
Yeah, either he's too good or he's too lazy, and both are bad. Either choice you get.
But yeah, both of those moves were horrible.
Yes, Tim, I picture in my mind, it's 1938, before World War II started. The leaders of Europe are meeting along with President Roosevelt, and there's a photo op. And either President Roosevelt, or we'll probably use Prime Minister Churchill because of the ability and disability issues, thinking of them pulling Hitler back just to be first. Now, we think, Hitler, what a piece of garbage. You know, nobody likes Hitler. Hitler getting shown up, good for everybody else. But I still cannot fathom somebody like Churchill or Roosevelt doing that even to a Hitler. That's how classless that looked. And, of course, we're talking about the Prime Minister of Montenegro. Have a funny feeling he's not even in the same, you know, atmosphere in any way as Adolf Hitler. What did you think?
If that would have been Putin, I bet he wouldn't have brushed him aside. He's rude. The man treats our allies with dismissive disrespect. He didn't mix well with any of them. He pretty much showed that he's not very interested, apparently, in our country, even remaining the leader of the free world. Russia must be delighted with what they saw over there with some of the things he did and said, especially to NATO. And now some have said, you know, that Angela Merkel is the leader of the free world. And how does he respond? Well, by attacking Germany on trade on Twitter. He swaggers and he's incompetent, a rather toxic combination. And Angela Merkel said, the day when we can rely on others for security are to some extent over. That's just as good as saying Europe's going to go their way. Europe's going to worry about Europe, and we can't depend on America anymore, even as a member of NATO. And, oh, by the way, did you guys see the look on the Pope's face in the photos with Trump? That to me, was the classic and seminal moment of that whole trip. What do you think, David?
it's just galling, everything he did. The Germany statement, the handshake with the French leader. Now, that was the French leader showing some assertion. Really, just Donald Trump was his photo op in that, for him to use Donald Trump to show some of his own, you know, strength, if you will. But such a bad scene. And I wonder if there will even be another overseas visit. I mean, even in the term. I mean, could he get away another overseas visit?
You didn't see, this is a classic. It's being discussed up there in Washington that he might want to jump on a plane and go over there to England to show solidarity with them. Now, who does he think wants to see him coming in England right now? Jeez.
Well, him saying he might do it and him doing it are two different things. You know, they say that he was just miserable on the trip. He likes his own bed and everything else. There's a lot of people in their 70s that like their own bed, they like to be home by dark, and all this litany of stuff. And those people all typically have one thing in common. They're retired. So if you'd like to join the list at any time, I personally won't stand in your way. Catherine, will you?
Yeah, no, that's great. Go ahead, retire.
He acts like the grumpy old man that hates the world, that, you know, yells at people from his front porch, which that's not even good, but that's not the leader of the world, leader of the country. And so with that negative sentiment, we leave you for the week, but we want to thank Lachlan McIntosh for coming on the show. And until next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity?